Welcome to That's What She Said, a podcast of sermons at Galileo Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. Galileo exists to seek and shelter spiritual refugees, who for us are people for whom the church has become boring, irrelevant, exclusive, or even painful, especially people who have been pushed out because of their gender or sexuality. If you yourself are a spiritual refugee, we're especially glad you're listening. And if you find this podcast helpful in your theological rehabilitation, consider partnering with us in its production. Become a financial sponsor of That's What She Said on Patreon, a platform for supporting content you love. Thanks!
Hey, church. I forgot to say a minute ago, I'm Katie. My pronouns are she, her. I'm the lead evangelist here at Galileo Church. I'm really glad to see y'all tonight. I'm glad to imagine the rest of you in your homes welcoming us into your space. Thank you. We're beginning tonight a new series for the season of Eastertide. The series is called Beholding, How We See Each Other. And in this series, over several weeks, we'll be preparing together for the renewal of the co-conspiracy of Galileo Church. Now, let me decipher everything I just said. Eastertide, I said. Perhaps you are aware that Easter is not a day on the Christian calendar, but actually a season. There are seven Sundays in the season of Eastertide. Last week was just the first. In the remaining Sundays of Eastertide, we imagine how the Easter proclamation that Jesus was indeed not in the tomb but raised from the dead impacts our lives as his disciples now. So welcome to the second Sunday of Eastertide. We'll keep going for several more weeks. The series is called Beholding, How We See Each Other. Beholding is a Ross Gayism. That is to say, it's a phrase used by the poet Ross Gay, with whose work I am more than mildly obsessed these days. It is a pun. Behold, like pay attention, you're seeing something. And for Ross, beholding. It's a way of being in relationship with each other. When we are in relationship with each other, we beholding each other. You see? And these ideas for the poet are related. The seeing each other in such a way as to hold each other. Seeing each other so that we may care for each other and cradle each other. Beholding is about seeing and being seen, about holding and being held. We're studying the Gospel of Mark in this way as preparation for the co-conspiracy of Galileo Church. The co-conspiracy is our annual recommitment, or new commitment for some of us, to prioritize the collective missional priorities of Galileo Church. Our church doesn't have membership per se, but every year we ask each other again if we'd like to co-conspire around the mission and missional priorities of Galileo Church. It goes Pentecost to Pentecost. Pentecost comes at the end of Eastertide. Right. And so for the co-conspiracy, our website lists seven practices of the co-conspiracy. You can find them on our website, galileochurch.org, under This Is Us. Join the co-conspiracy. And we'll be taking these practices of the co-conspiracy one at a time over the next several weeks so that by the time we get to Pentecost and it's time to say yes or not to the co-conspiracy, you'll know what you're saying yes to. We actually started last week. We just didn't say it out loud. Last week, we thought about one of our practices, which is the contemplation of our baptisms, past or future. This week, we're talking about another of the practices, the extension of the church's welcome to friends, neighbors, strangers, and enemies. Now, we're going to begin back at the beginning of Mark's gospel. We're sort of rewinding back to almost the very start, and I want to just say that for Mark, things move fast. So by the time we pick up our reading near the end of chapter 1, Jesus has already been baptized, and then flung into the desert to endure trials. He has come out of the desert back to civilization, preaching the reign of God. He has called some disciples. He has exorcised a whole bunch of demons. He has healed a whole bunch of sick folks. He has slipped away from the crowds to pray in private. He has announced to his followers that they have to move it, get on through Galilee to keep proclaiming their message about the reign of God. It's a lot in a hurry in Mark's first chapter. And we pick up in Mark chapter 1, verse 40. A man with a skin disease came to him, begging him, and kneeling, he said to him, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I am willing, be made clean." Immediately, the skin disease left him, and he was made clean. After sternly warning him, he sent him away at once, saying to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely, and to spread the word, so that Jesus could no longer go into a town openly, but stayed out in the country, and people came to him from every quarter. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So if I say, it turns out Bruce Willis was dead the whole time, do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, great. The 1999 movie, The Sixth Sense, by M. Night Shyamalan-a-ding-dong, about the troubled little boy who, it turns out, sees dead people, right? Well, if you don't, well, that's your assignment for tonight. You got to see it so that reading Mark's gospel will finally make sense. No, not really. But kind of really. Because here's the thing. There are certain pieces of literature, movies, novels, short stories that have a twist at the very end so profound that it reshapes every plot point, every image, every line of dialogue that comes before it. They're the kinds of stories that you want to, nay, have to read again, see again, experience again after you know the ending, so that you can pick up the signs all along the way that were always pointing to this outcome. You could have guessed that Bruce Willis's character was a ghost if you'd been looking for the color red, or if you'd noticed how he can't turn a doorknob, or whatever. So remember last Sunday, the very end of Mark's gospel, chapter 16, where the women come to the tomb to anoint his corpse, only there's no corpse, but instead a messenger waiting in the tomb, and they freak out, run away in terror, and, quote, said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And the gospel just ends there. Like, no Jesus, no announcement to the rest of the disciples, no nothing, because they say nothing to anyone. Hardest Easter text for preaching ever. Now, from Mark 16, just rewind to Mark chapter 1. And listen again to what Jesus tells the dude formerly known for his skin disease. "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest," etc., etc. Ta-da! Had Mark not ended his gospel the way he did, and had we not already just read that ending just last week, what Jesus says here in chapter 1 might not make its way to the front of our minds. It might register as something kind of weird for a Messiah to say. I mean, if you were the Messiah, wouldn't you want people to know it? How can you save them if they don't know you're doing it? But Mark's very weird ending ensures that we will pick up on Jesus' insistence on secrecy every time he gives these instructions in the gospel, which he will, kind of a lot. starting here in chapter 1 and repeated as he tells demons who know his name to shut the hell up, and beneficiaries of his powers are ordered to keep mum. Like in chapter 5, when he raises a little girl from the honest to God death and strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Now, besides the fact that somebody obviously spilled the beans or we wouldn't even know about it, I really love here that Jesus is interested, as he always is, in everybody getting enough to eat, including little girls he has just raised from the dead. Eat up, little girls. Are you listening? Eat up. This man does not miss a reason to eat, and he wants you to eat too. Thanks be to God. Anyway, Jesus insists on secrecy so often in Mark's telling that it actually becomes a meme with a name. The Messianic Secret. Messiah, Messianic. The secret about the Messiah. About which scholars of Mark's gospel have spilled a lot of ink. I mean, in one sense, as I've said, it seems to work against the purpose of his ministry, if indeed he sees himself as the world's savior. Can you imagine how mad his PR team would be? Don't put this on Insta, he would insist, holding his hand over the camera lens. I don't give interviews. I don't pose for selfies with fans. What I'm doing here is not for public consumption. Shh. I mean, okay, sure, Jesus. You're just going to save the world on the down low with your low-budget indie campaign. Whatever you say, man, you're the Messiah. In another way, for the lightning-fast pace of Mark's story, it kind of makes sense. In chapter 1, word is already spreading about Jesus' power to put broken lives back together. He expels one little demon who interrupts his teaching in the Capernaum synagogue, telling it in no uncertain terms to keep his name out of its mouth. And chapter 1, verse 28, his fame began to spread throughout the surrounding region of Galilee. Next up, he heals Peter's mother-in-law so she can make them all lunch. In chapter 1, verse 33, the whole city gathered at the door needing things from him, and he has to make a midnight escape just to get enough privacy to pray. See, he's getting too famous, too fast, so the reasoning goes. And so he asks his beneficiaries not to spread the word. He needs time, right? Time to think, to teach and to preach, to develop his message apart from the gee-whizness of the miracles. The crowds can be dangerously visible. He doesn't want the Romans or the religious authorities to get too worked up. It's early yet in his own self-discovery as God's Messiah. He doesn't yet know the extent of what he can do. He needs time. And so, messianic secret. It doesn't really work, obviously. Again and again, the ones he instructs to keep quiet end up giving away his secret immediately and widely. There's absolutely no record of his ever being mad about that. But as many times as he says it, by the time you get to chapter 16 and the women run away from his tomb, speechless with fear, saying nothing to anyone, we who have seen this movie all the way to the end can't help but wonder if he is finally getting what he wanted all along. His favorite people, the ones he loves, saying nothing to anyone. Now, can we just pause here for a brief biblical geography lesson? You'll thank me later, I know. Amber, we have a slide for this, yeah? Okay, it's important to know that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke all agree that the bulk of Jesus' ministry happened in Galilee. Galilee, up there in red, you see? Which is the northern region of what had formerly been the land occupied by the geopolitical entity known as Israel. Galilee was mostly rural villages and countryside, farmers and fishermen, some craftsmen like Jesus's adoptive dad, small local synagogues in towns that were large enough to get a minyan together. That's the 10 Jewish men required to be present for study and prayer. Not every town could do it. Jerusalem, by contrast, is southerly on this map. the urban seat of religious and political power for the whole area. And it's not in Galilee, it's in Judea, the southern part of old Israel. And the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, mostly agree that adult Jesus only went there once for that last Passover meal in the last week of his life, and a rapid escalation of hostilities all the way to his execution in just a few days' time. It's likely that his entire ministry was almost completely in Galilee, and it only lasted 8 or 9 months. In Galilee, all the poor and the sick and the generally ignored by the powers that be received his preaching as very good news, indeed, the very best news. The opposition he encounters in Galilee is very often people who have traveled from Jerusalem, the VRPs, the very religious person scouting out his ministry in the north. He told his neighbors in that part of the world, God is for you. And then he demonstrated that by his healing touch. Jesus was popular in Galilee. He was famous in Galilee. He was well loved in Galilee, which is why his disciples discouraged him from traveling south to Jerusalem. Don't go, they would say. There's nothing for trouble, nothing but trouble for you in the big city. Just stay up here, stay here in Galilee where they like you, where they need you, where they appreciate all that you can do for them. Okay, enough geography. But keep the geography in your mind and fast forward with me to the end of Mark's gospel again. The women are at the tomb in or near Jerusalem. Jesus is not. The young man dressed in white, hanging out in the cave, says that they should go tell Peter and all the disciples what? That they need to hustle up because Jesus has gone ahead of them. He is already well on his way. Where? To Galilee. Chapter 16, verse 7. He is going ahead of you to Galilee. And there you will see him just as he told you. The risen Lord is headed back to the countryside, to the rural villages, to the scene of his early success, to his home base, and they should meet him there. They are all going back to the site of the messianic secret, the let's just keep this between us deal that he kept insisting on. Back to the place where he preached and taught, healed and exorcised, fed and forgave crowds of eager followers. It's just that this time, he'll walk the country roads of Galilee with scarred feet. He will touch the bodies of the diseased with mangled hands. There will be no one who has not heard about his excruciating ending, at least the ending they expected for him when he took off for Jerusalem a couple weeks earlier. Imagine now, if you will, that in his second stint in Galilee post-Easter, he meets again the formerly skin-diseased man. How might that encounter go? Jesus, my man, the fellow might call from a distance, rushing over for a high five. Hey, it's good to see you. We all heard you were. And then he would see Jesus' hand raised in reply, the ragged wound. And in a long embrace, he would feel the raised tissue of healing stripes across his back. Oh, he might say softly, stepping back to take a better inventory of damage so recently done, so newly healing. Oh, I see. And that's when it would hit. The reason for the ridiculous secrecy at first, the reasoning behind his wish that they would wait to tell his story, because what they knew then was not nearly the whole story. In Galilee, the first time, he was a healer, a beloved teacher, someone to celebrate. In Jerusalem, he was a threat, a problem, someone to eliminate. In Galilee, compassionate justice won him friends. In Jerusalem, the very same work won him arrest by the empire in collusion with religious hierarchy and abandonment by his friends. Same Jesus, both places, different reception, to say the least. So, the messenger at the tomb says he's headed back to Galilee, back to where this whole thing started. Only now that you know the ending, the beginning is going to hit different. Meet him there. You'll see. It's like Mark is saying to us, to his readers through the ages, that his rendering of Jesus has to come full circle, not just for them, but for us too. We are the women at the tomb. We are the skin-diseased man he heals. We can't say anything about him until we have reckoned with the end, after which we can rewind to the beginning and tell it true. It's like we don't really read Mark's gospel or Jesus' life in a straight line from beginning to end. We read it in a circle. Just bend that line so that the ending brings us back to the beginning, following him back to Galilee, reliving his ministry there, now that we know what's going to happen. Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. It matters because in the Galileo co-conspiracy, we are committed to this practice of doing what Jesus told a whole bunch of people not to do. Don't tell anybody what I've done for you, he said. But we know that they did, eventually. The women said nothing to anyone, Mark said. But we know that they did, eventually. And we believe that now, having walked with him to Jerusalem, having stayed with him through those long last days and nights, it is time for us to tell. That's all it means, really, the extension of the church's welcome to friends, neighbors, strangers, and enemies, one of the practices of our co-conspiracy. It means that we have developed a way of talking about him and what he's done for us and what it has cost him. It's not a naive telling like he was trying to prevent at first, where everything is rosy, and if you'll just get with Jesus, he'll make everything all right forever, starting now. That would be false testimony. It's the kind you might give if he healed you, and then you told all your people how great he was, but you didn't know yet how it would go for him at the end. Rather, we are committed here to an eyes wide open kind of testimony where we say how scary it can be to stay with him, how exhausting it can be to always feel like you're going against the grain of your neighbors, how much math we are always doing about whether it's worth it to still call ourselves Christians. Honestly, whether it's still valuable or even viable to do life with a group of quirky queer believers like us, i.e., a church. Whether we've got enough gumption to keep claiming his message as our own, given how unpopular it can be in certain places, to stand up for the poor and powerless, the small and despised. Given how close we are on any given day to our own Jerusalems, the places and the people that will not tolerate another word about a Messiah who blesses and prefers the marginalized. I think that's how Jesus wants us to tell it. The whole truth, Galilee and Jerusalem, super happy fun time, and this road is fucking hard. Both. All, the full circle, because that is the truth. And unless we can tell it all, he'd rather we just keep quiet.
Thanks for listening to That's What She Said. If what you've heard is helpful, consider becoming a patron of its production by joining our subscribers on Patreon. This podcast is preached almost always by our lead evangelist, Reverend Dr. Katie Hayes. Galileo Church has 5 missional priorities. We do justice for LGBTQ+ people and support the people who love them. We do kindness around mental health and mental illness, and we celebrate neurodiversity. We do beauty for our God who is beautiful. We do real relationship, no bullshit, ever. And we do whatever it takes to share this good news with the world God still loves. To support our missional priorities, go to galileochurch.org and click on Share With Us. You'll have options to contribute through Venmo, PayPal, or your bank account. And if you're kind enough to share your contact information with us, we'll continually send you thanks. Peace.